Hello, and welcome back to Opposition Cast. I'm Nigel Fletcher. And in this episode, we're going to be looking at an issue which has become all too topical in recent years, and indeed in recent days. And that is the issue of abuse that MPs and politicians face nowadays, both online and in terms of their own physical safety. It's one of the factors that I think is quite striking about political opposition is that it is inherently an adversarial concept. When you oppose something that somebody else is doing, that is by necessity a form of conflict. And politics, in any democratic system in any case, is the way that we resolve that conflict by peaceful means. So there is clearly a tension and a balancing act to be struck between the level of passionate opposition that you may have about a particular issue and the need to conduct that in a peaceful and civil way. And that's particularly topical this week and in the last 24 hours indeed, when we've heard the news from the Conservative Minister and Member of Parliament Mike Freer that he is standing down from Parliament, citing the very real threats to his own personal safety that he has faced. In his letter to his constituency chairman, standing down, he says that since his election as an MP in 2010, he sadly had several serious threats to his personal safety. And he cites a number of those, attacks by the organisation Muslims Against Crusade and others, and the recent arson attack where his constituency office was attacked and there was a serious fire there. He also cites the impact of all of this on his husband, Angelo, and his wider family. He says that these incidents have placed an intolerable stress both on him and on his family. And in an interview that he's given to a newspaper today, he's also said that the final straw was that arson attack in his constituency, and that there comes a point, he said, when the threats to your personal safety become too much. And this is certainly something that we should be mindful of, given the fact that in 2021, the MP for Southend West, Sir David Amos, was killed at his constituency surgery. And Mike Freer states that it's come to light since then that he himself was targeted by the same person who went on to commit that murder. And before that, in 2016, we had the tragic murder of the Labour MP, Jo Cox, outside her constituency surgery. So these are clearly very real threats to the personal and physical safety of our MPs, alongside that more low-level, as Mike Freer describes it, level of abuse that MPs and their staff receive on a daily basis on social media and elsewhere. And it's that culture of abuse and threats to politicians, both at a national and local level, that forms the basis of a new report that came out last week from the Jo Cox Foundation, which was established in the wake of Jo Cox's murder to continue some of the work and the causes that she believed in. And I was fortunate to be able to speak to the chair of the Jo Cox Foundation, the former Labour Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, who was a friend of Jo Cox and who now chairs that foundation, about the report, which came out from the Civility Commission that the foundation had set up. That report was published last week. We spoke yesterday before the news from Mike Freer about him standing down from Parliament, and I began by asking Jackie to just introduce the foundation and its work and to say a little about how she got involved with it.
So the Jo Cox Foundation was set up in 2016 when, of course, Jo was tragically murdered by friends and colleagues who wanted to be able to continue the work in line with Jo's values. And I'm enormously proud to have chaired it now for over 4 years, actually, having known Jo as a friend, being very clear that had she not died, I think she would have been an enormously important player politically. And, you know, just a good friend with a very good sense of politics and a strong set of values. And of course, famously, Jo said in her maiden speech when she was elected to Parliament that she described her community and she said, but we have more in common than that that divides us.
The thing that surprises me time and time again as I travel around the constituency is that we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us.
And that's been a sort of theme for the work that we do. So we have three strands of work. The first is around what we call our local pillar, so bringing communities together, particularly across difference, manifest particularly by the great get-together that we hold every year, and in work that we're developing to try and build partnerships that do that task of bringing people together. Then we've got an international strand of what we call our Fairer World work, because of course Jo had a background in international development. So we've had projects that have been funded by overseas development aid money in Jo's name. Then the third strand relates to Jo's commitment around involving more people in politics. And I first met Jo actually when she was the chair of Labour Women's Network, and we were working together to try to get more women involved, particularly in the Labour Party and elected to Parliament. And, you know, we've done a range of work there. But what we've increasingly identified is that abuse and intimidation of elected politicians is essentially a fundamental attack on our democracy. And of course, at its most extreme, it veers over into the, you know, the terrorism essentially that killed Jo, that of course then subsequently killed David Amos. But our aim here is less about thinking about how Jo died and more about how she lived in terms of that real wish to encourage more people to get engaged in politics. And the problem with abuse and intimidation is it affects everybody. It puts good people off wanting to be involved in politics, but it actually has a disproportionate impact on women, on LGBTQ plus people, on disabled people, and particularly on people of colour. And therefore, it makes our representation in politics and the strength of our democracy even worse than it would otherwise be. And the other important thing that we always say about Jo is that she didn't believe that there were problems that you put in the too difficult pile. So lots of people have said to me, we see the issue, but actually, what can you do about it practically? So we set out with the commission to find with the co-chair of co-chairing of Gabby Burton and Vernon Coker, who've been great doing this. We set out to find some practical recommendations, and that's what we were able to publish, 28 of them last week.
Mm. And as you say, it is a very difficult problem to crack. And looking through the report, I mean, there are some very sort of practical recommendations there, things that the government needs to do to focus on it, and you've got some recommendations on for the police as well about what they could do. But I think what struck me was that sort of perhaps the most important of them is really just to sort of change behaviour, to sort of lead by example. There's the civility pledge as well that's highlighted there. A lot of this is for politicians themselves to try and change their behaviour as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, in the context of what we talk about in opposition, it's quite a difficult thing to get the balance right, isn't it, between legitimate opposition and quite robust debate and what can spill over into abuse. Because it's not just about the public and other people abusing politicians. Perhaps they're taking the cue from what they're seeing of politicians themselves.
I mean, I think that's a really important point, Nigel, especially, and, you know, the whole point about politics is, and the whole point, you know, about your focus on opposition is, politics is about setting up ideas and people against each other. You know, that's at the heart of our democracy. You can't have a democratic system unless you can have robust debates, unless you can define the differences between you, unless you can challenge from opposition those who are in government. So there is nothing about the commission and the recommendations that is about sanitising that. And, you know, I've joked that, you know, well, Joe certainly had very, very strong views and expressed them. You know, she wasn't somehow or another. This more in common argument was not about some sort of mushy, you know, there is no difference between us. It was actually about saying there is a difference between us, but actually what we share is a common humanity and hopefully for most politicians, a wish, an attempt to make things better, even if we disagree about the means by which we do that. You know, I've never backed off an argument. Gabby and Vernon are hardly a pair of sort of softies. What stifles debate and limits that ability, for example, to be able to oppose effectively, I would argue, is people being put off the democratic process and the discussion because they think, well, actually, if I raise these issues or if I take this particular position, am I going to be showered with shit, basically? Am I going to be abused in doing that? And a very scary, I think, thing that some of the research has identified, because we talk to lots of politicians, current and former politicians, and they are telling us that they mediate what they say, and in some cases they mediate their views on the basis of wanting to avoid abuse. Now that is a really dangerous place to be if people don't feel able to express what they really think about an issue because, you know, because of the abuse that they're going to face. So there is nothing soft or woolly about it. Actually, it is abuse and intimidation that limits debate and you know, disagreement in politics. It doesn't facilitate it. And on this point about politicians' behaviour, I mean, you know, you're not a what, you know, a sort of catch you out sort of interviewer, Nigel. So I'm sure you're not going to do the, ah, yes, but what about Angela Rayner, or ah, yes, but what about so-and-so? Because, you know, there is a fine line, or there is a sort of blurred area, actually, to be completely frank, between really robust argument, debate, challenge, negative campaigning even, which of course I suspect we're going to be seeing during the course of this year, all of which I think are legitimate. And the point at which it crosses over into something, I think my criteria for this, the more I've thought about it, is the thing that you are saying about your opponent or about the politician dehumanizing and questioning of their fundamental motives? And if it is, that's abuse and intimidation. I mean, obviously, we then get into all the other things that people experience, like death threats, rape threats, etc. Really horrible, serious stuff. But if you cannot make your point without suggesting that somehow somebody is, you know, crooked, corrupt, or less human than you, well, then I think you need to rethink how it is that you're engaging in that discussion, in that debate.
Looking at sort of politicians' behaviours, as you say, you've had your fair share of robust debates, including on television with certain commentators. If I were being a bit unfair, I might bring that one up.
That clearly wasn't
so
the case.
You make it more difficult.
Oh, Isabel, shut up.
Excuse me.
Hang on.
But there is, you know, there is a serious point there, isn't there? That this is, you know, the cuff and thrust of debate is perfectly legitimate. You say that deciding where that crosses over into abuse is more complex. But in many of the cases that you're talking about, there's no question when we're talking about you know, death threats, you know, references to rape and sexual abuse, you know, all of these sorts of things that happen that have been reported. It's quite clear. So what are the recommendations in the report about how you deal with what we can agree are, you know, is clear abuse of politicians?
Well, first of all, there are some short-term improvements in the sort of security that goes around MPs that we've talked about. So there has been, sadly, because of Joe and David Amis, there has been a lot of progress. That the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, has led a lot of work in Parliament, in the Security Directorate, and across the police to improve the security, the physical security and the general protection around MPs. But we make some recommendations around ensuring that that's consistent, ensuring it's consistent across the country, because of course the point about MPs is they operate in their constituencies, they operate, you know, they live in quite often in their communities. And also, of course, we make recommendations as well that go beyond the MP themselves. One of the most distressing things about the abuse that MPs face is that it impacts on everybody around them. It impacts on their families, it impacts on their staff. Sometimes some MPs, usually sort of late middle-aged men, have said to me, I don't really get this abuse. And then you talk to their offices and what their offices say is, well, we do, it's just we don't tell him about it. So it's the most junior members of your staff who go in every morning and have to open the email to know that they're going to be confronted by horrible abuse. So one of the things we've recommended is that actually there is a responsibility on MPs, firstly, to understand what constitutes actionable or recordable abuse and intimidation, and secondly, to report it. Because it doesn't matter if you don't want to take action about it, we need to get a better idea, the police need to get a better idea about where that abuse is coming from and what the nature of it is. And sometimes, of course, to join the dots for an individual who might be abusing a range of different people. So there's more security for the MPs and for their family, and advice and support for their families and their staff. There's a requirement to sort of report that, and a role for government in coordinating the action that's being taken and the responses that are being made. There's also, of course, an emphasis in the report on local government as well, because I think we've tended to focus on what happens at a national level. In local government, people are being put off, and in some ways they're even more open to their communities than MPs are protected. So there are things that we think need to happen in local government. And then, of course, there's the issue of the election period, when people who are not currently elected politicians are entering into the fray by standing for election. And there's a range of things that need to be done there to provide support to candidates. The civility pledge that we are asking all political parties to expect their candidates to sign up to in the way in which they behave to each other. And of course, what happens on social media. Now, this is not only about social media, but undoubtedly social media facilitates the worst sort of abuse. And some social media companies have been taking this more seriously than others. But there is more that they can do, particularly around elections, both to protect candidates and, of course, also linked, but slightly different, to help to make sure that they're tackling the misinformation and the way in which sometimes abuse is used actually to as a form of misinformation. And then this brings me also on to another important point in the recommendations, which is about political literacy. A lot of people talked about the fact that quite often the abuse that they face, they think, comes from a pretty fundamental misunderstanding about what they can and can't do as an elected politician. And people need to both understand better the impact of abuse, and they also need to understand the decisions that politicians are making and the nature of the democratic process that they're involved in. All sounds a bit pompous. Actually, we think that starting, you know, improving political literacy at a school level and then carrying that forward in terms of awareness raising about what elections are, what people are standing for, will also help with tackling some of the abuse and intimidation that comes from a sort of fundamental misunderstanding of what politicians are there for, really.
Yes. And that's a really interesting point, because I think a lot of the abuse that the politicians receive, and you know, speaking as a former politician myself in a local context, you know, it does come from a frustration, doesn't it? It comes from people who are, you know, at their wit's end often about something that has happened to them or which they feel is an injustice. You know, a lot of the sort of more serious forms of you mentioned in the report about sort of stalking and sort of obsessive individuals. I think there are a lot of politicians who will be familiar with that, where you have individuals who, you know, at the heart of it, there is a grievance that has sort of magnified and gone into this sort of unacceptable level of abuse. But lots of the rest of it is just a general frustration. It's a frustration at the political process, and politicians just aren't listening. And I think for local politicians, certainly in my experience, it's planning committees who sort of will see the most sort of visceral kind of public anger. And often there, I found that there is a misunderstanding about the nature of what the committee can do and can't do. Yeah. And a number of times I saw chairs of committees sort of beginning the process by trying to deliver what you're saying, which is the education function of saying, it's important for you to understand what we can and can't do here this evening. But, you know, that is part of a sort of a wider need to educate people about that. The other thing I thought about local government that you mentioned there is that, I think in my experience, in a way, local authorities as public institutions are probably more capable of dealing with sort of abuse in a more systematic way than Parliament is. And this is one of the problems I think that the MPs perhaps have and MPs staff have, is that in Parliament, you don't have really an HR function. This has come up in relation to bullying and abuse allegations within parliaments, that you don't have that. Local authorities, I think, tend to have that. And certainly when I've had any kind of issues with sort of abuse or any kind of threats that we've had, there is an institution there. You know, you've got the council function, and the head of legal can get in touch and say, this is what we're doing about this. My sense is that in Parliament, there isn't really that level of support. Is that part of the problem, that we do have this system of you know, MPs are technically and constitutionally all individuals, and there isn't this sort of collective support for them, and as you say, for their staff as well?
Well, first off, I'm glad that you did receive that support in local government, Nigel, because actually one of the things that some local councillors have said and that the LGA have said is that some local authorities haven't taken that sort of duty of care seriously enough. So I think, you know, it's good where they are doing that. And I can see your point about the structures enabling that, perhaps more than in Parliament. No, you're right. I mean, all sorts of problems, of course, have come from MP, the individualistic nature of MPs' sort of employment relationships from expenses onwards. And it is the case that it took a bit of time before I think Parliament took seriously its responsibility for the security of MPs and their staff. And there are still sort of anomalies. So it took, we talk in the report about things like how you account for the money that MPs have to spend to protect themselves. Now, if that goes into your expenses claim, that, as we all know, that means MPs find it much more difficult on an individual basis to put in place what they need for themselves and their offices to remain safe. So there needs to be, and this point about not reporting because you sort of don't think it affects you. And there are some MPs who see it as, and I sort of get this, who see it as a sign of weakness if they've been abused. They're the victim, but they don't really want to talk about it because they don't want to be pictured like that. So what you then need is you need the institution to take responsibility for protecting MPs and protecting their families and staff. And the justification for doing that, the argument that we have to make to MPs about that is, frankly, it doesn't really matter what you as an individual feel like. What we're suffering from here is a fundamental attack on democracy and on the ability of anybody to do their job properly and of those who come after you to do their job properly. So, you know, back off and let us defend you and protect you in the way that, you know, we think is important. And that's why, to be honest, that's why I think I've got quite an important role. You know, I am not a frontline politician anymore. Nobody's going to turn around to me. Well, they might do, but, you know, and say, well, you're only interested in protecting yourself. You know, you're just trying to stop people from criticizing you. All of a sudden, people do say to politicians, I can say, no, sorry, this is not a self-interested thing for me, except that I want to live in a country where people are able and want to stand for election, to express their real views, to get out and about and meet the electorate. I want that sort of country, because we all suffer if we haven't got a country like that. If only the thickest skinned, you know, blokes largely feel able to come into a political life. Well, that's not a country I want to live in.
Yeah. And you come up with a very interesting paradox there, which is that often, you know, whether it's out of a sort of misplaced sense of sort of machismo, or whether it's kind of because of, you know, well, I've got a thick skin, or that they're just not seeing a lot of it, there is perhaps a resistance by some MPs themselves to want to complain about this. And also, there's the fact that it often invites further abuse when politicians start complaining about themselves, which is another problem. So often they don't perhaps feel that they can do this. And particularly, as you mentioned, with the issues on expenses, to be seen to be spending public money on your own protection can also seem to be something that might invite criticism and abuse. I just want to go on that point as well, because you know, clearly the origins of the Jo Cox Foundation came from her, you know, horrific murder in 2016, and we have since then had, as you mentioned at the beginning, another MP who has been murdered during the course of his work, in David Amos. Is this something which, you know, clearly this is at the extreme end of this? We're talking predominantly about sort of the culture of abuse. But as you say, this is a spectrum, and at the extreme end of it, we are talking about physical threats to MPs. I've always felt that this is something which isn't taken as seriously as it should be. And it is quite extraordinary that we have had two occasions and many others in the past in which MPs have been seriously injured as well in their constituency surgeries. Yeah. And yet we still don't seem to take this as seriously as perhaps we might. You know, you yourself as Home Secretary received police protection. You didn't have any choice over that. You know, that was something which goes with the job, because there's a perceived threat and you receive round-the-clock police protection. You know, as someone who's had that experience as well, you know, is this something that you're particularly aware of? Because I've always wondered about the sort of, you know, mentality of MPs facing those threats. If you're in a position like you were, there is clearly a threat, because you've had to be provided with extra protection for that. You know, it must make you very much more aware of it. So I just wonder, sort of, you know, from that perspective, as you say, not being in the front line now, but seeing it having happened to other people, is there something that we really need to make much more of a priority?
Well, I think we do. That's why we're, you know, emphasising in the commission report that this is not something, first of all, it's not something that you should just have to put up with because you're in political life, which is sometimes what people say, oh, well, you know, what you're on about, it's part of, you know, the argy-bargy of political life. Well, as I've already said, argy-bargy of political life is fine. Personal abuse and intimidation is not fine. And it's not impossible to work out which is which. secondly, it's getting worse. You know, this is not something that has always been the same. All of the research evidence, my personal experience, tells me that the abuse that is faced by elected politicians is worse now and is continuing to get worse. So we need to intervene to stop that from happening. And then, you know, thirdly, it isn't about you as an individual. You know, so some people would say, yeah, but, you know, I go down the pub and somebody has a go at me. Well, number one, that's wrong, but that isn't an attack on your democratic system. So the reason we make that point is, one, because it's true, but two, because it identifies the responsibility of more people to actually help us to address the problem. And so coming back to your first point, Nigel, there is something, there is a sort of mention in the report about supporting each other. So one of the things politicians need to do is, it's quite hard to defend yourself, but you can defend other people. And it's really powerful when MPs defend somebody who is not in their political party and call out abuse to them, number one. And secondly, I think members of the public and people like me, who's fortunate to have a voice, need to call out when others are abusing parliamentarians, particularly those who don't share our political views.
And just to finish on that point, you talk about sort of cross-party sort of support. That's another part of this sort of civility and kind of leading by example. I mean, you yourself have a very successful podcast with Ian Dale, based on the idea that, you know, you are two people from different sides of the political spectrum, you know, who are able to occasionally disagree, and to have,
right, we don't disagree enough. Yeah,
exactly. Yes, this is one of the criticisms that you're becoming too civil to one another. But there is the sort of the difference, isn't there, between civility and disagreement, this is, you know, an example of that. So, you know, lots of other people are doing it now. You know, you've got these Johnny Come Lately podcasts popping up now, which have a similar thing. But, you know, that idea of people seeing politicians or former politicians being able to remain true to their political beliefs whilst being civil to one another, that is an important part of this as well, isn't it? This is the sort of leading by example. Is that quite a difficult thing to get across to the electorate? Because I think it's understandable that people do think that perhaps if they see politicians who are, you know, disagreeing in public and then talking to one another in a civil way, often the charge that comes across from people is that, well, you know, in that case, they're not sincere in what they're saying. They're all in it together. There is a bit of a difficulty there, isn't there, sometimes, to get people to understand that, no, we do genuinely disagree, but we don't have to be at each other's throats and be, you know, nasty to one another.
I think that's a really important point, Nigel. You know, and I am a lot less tribal now than I used to be when I was in Parliament. And frankly, I used to think to myself, oh, it's all a bit chummy, isn't it? Well, you know, why are people being nice to each other? Because, you know, we've got a fundamentally ideologically different view of the world. Well, this is where we come back to this idea of political literacy, because in a democratic system, the way that you deliver your values and your ideology is through standing for election, hopefully getting elected, making your case in Parliament, being clear about what the difference is between you and what else is being proposed, and actually delivering it. So that's not chummy, but it involves a collective activity and an organisation of democracy and people being willing to be part of it in order to do it. And that takes a bit of explaining. And that's why I think that's part of the task as well. You know, I don't have to, you know, so I've never kissed a Tory T-shirt. I understand, you know, where, and by the way, I don't want this to be all po-faced either. You know, I think there is a lot of humour in the challenge that politicians make of each other. I think that is fine. If you're sort of slightly taking the mickey out of somebody, that's good if it's a powerful person that you're doing it to. But you don't have to hate the individual. I mean, I could hate a set of views. I don't have to hate the individual in order to prosecute an argument against them or to try to defeat them at the ballot box either. Mm.
And finally, sort of, what is the call to action? You've got this report. You mentioned this is going to be almost certainly an election year. What can people who are concerned about this, who think this is a very important issue, What can they do?
So, first of all, they can go to the Joe Cox Foundation website. They can actually look at the report. It's not a massively lengthy report. They can see some of the recommendations. Secondly, they can donate money, because this is the first part of our process. The second part is actually continuing to build the really broad coalition that has come together around this. So that's, as I said, that's politicians. It's also the Electoral Commission, Ofcom, the Local Government Association, Fawcett Society, loads of others as well who are supporting the work and help us to get these recommendations put into operation. Thirdly, they can just do that thing of calling it out when they see it. So, you know, think to yourself, you know, don't put yourself in line for a load of abuse. But if you're in a position where you can call out people being abusive to politicians, just do it. Be an active bystander rather than simply thinking to yourself, oh, well, it's horrible, but that's a fact of life. It doesn't have to be. And we can change that.
Great. Jackie Smith, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Jackie Smith there speaking to me yesterday about the Joe Cox Foundation's new report of their Civility Commission that came out last week. And as I say, with the news in the last 24 hours from Mike Freer, that has become, I think, even more topical and important. So, as Jackie said, there are many things that you could yourself do, not least ensuring that you are someone who calls out these things. And I think that's quite an important lesson for some MPs to take, regardless of party. And it's been quite heartening, I have to say, looking at social media today, to see that across the political spectrum, from all sides of the House of Commons and beyond, there's been an awful lot of support and sympathy for Mike Freer and the situation that he has found himself in. And I think that's something which does go with the grain of what Jackie was talking to me about. If you want to read the report, I recommend having a look at it. It is on the Joe Cox Foundation website, joecoxfoundation.org, and you can also see the other work that they are doing in that foundation on this issue of countering abuse in politics. That's all we've got for you on this podcast. I always want to say that's all we've got time for, but of course time is infinite on a podcast. That's all we've got for you on this episode of Opposition Cast. I hope you found it interesting, and if so, please make sure that you have liked and subscribed, as they say. Subscribe to the podcast so that you are notified of future episodes. Do listen back to the back catalogue as well, and spread the word. Let people know about Opposition Cast, particularly, I think, this episode, which is particularly topical this week. So if you found it on social media, do please retweet and spread the word. But we'll be back again with another episode in a couple of weeks' time. Going to be trying to do that regularly throughout this year, with the occasional extra emergency podcast thrown in there for good measure as well. But until then, thanks very much for joining me. Do look after yourselves, and I'll see you again soon. You've been listening to Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies, presented by me, Nigel Fletcher. Our theme music is by Tom Hector, and you can find us on Twitter at OppositionUK and online at oppositionstudies.net.
That we are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us.